Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. I'm Joe Saul Sehy from Stacking Benjamins, driving the bus on today's episode. Have you ever wanted to get in on some of those deals you always hear about? You know, the ones that, like the deals on the show Shark Tank, right? Where people are asking you to invest some money instead of those sharks. They have this awesome idea and you want to put money in the pot. Does that sound good? Well, the U.S. government has a new ruling that appears on the surface to let you do just that. So I'm pleased we have an expert in that area as our guest. Greg Flynn is the Chief Investment Officer at ALTZ Investment Strategies. He's worked in the financial industry for over 19 years, focusing on alternative investments for the past 10 years. And his company is a pioneer in this new crowdfunding investment arena. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thanks for having me on, Joe. Great to be here.
Now, is it ALTZ? Did I get that right?
We call it, it's like alt, right? So it's like Lyft, where you can't spell Lyft with right. an I. That's the idea.
Like I have skills with a Z. It's alts with a Z.
Exactly. Right. You got mad skills for sure.
Well, let's talk about this. What is the new ruling that on the surface lets you and I get in on some of these venture capital deals?
Yeah. So it originally comes from the Jobs Act, which was passed way back in April 2012. And it's actually taken 3.5-4 years to get actually the regulations in place. Technically, it's called, you know, Title III, and it's Regulation CF, Regulation Crowdfunding, which is really the truest form of equity crowdfunding. There's other platforms out there that people consider equity crowdfunding, but they're really doing is doing accredited investor crowdfunding, and that's someone who either has a net worth of $1 million or annual income over $200,000. And that's kind of always been out there, but this is really the first time that anyone is capable of investing in a startup.
That's really exciting. So ostensibly then, I can get in on some great deal like Facebook, the next Facebook, and make a bunch of money.
We hope so. I think that's maybe the intent. And the challenge is, has there been some sort of regulation that's occurred when they tried to get this thing enacted that might preclude that from happening?
Okay.
There's a couple things when they pass this Title III that kind of make it maybe not as advantageous or as exciting as we all hoped it would be, because everyone knows Kickstarter and Indiegogo. I guess the biggest example is Oculus Rift, right? So Oculus Rift was raising money, and I don't know if it was Indiegogo or Kickstarter, but they were basically selling the camera, the VR camera, and then it gets bought out by Facebook.
Yeah, like the goggles. Those are the goggles, yeah. Right? Yeah, okay.
And it gets bought out for $2 billion. And you kind of had everyone saying, wait a second, we were buying these goggles and you guys just made $2 billion off us buying these goggles that we don't even have. And to me, that's where everyone starts to see, wow, I could have invested in that company
right.
instead of buying that goggle. I'd be rich. And that's really the, you know, I think what everyone thinks of when they think of how effective it could be. Unfortunately, there's a number of regulations that kind of, I think, inhibit it. The first one is you can't do this thing that's called test the waters. And what that means is, I'm just thinking of doing a deal or raising money, and I could go through social media and say, hey, I'm thinking of raising money for my company. It's this really cool idea. It's this VR set of glasses. Would you think of investing? If you do, sign up. You can't do that at all. So this idea of being able to use social media to basically attract investors doesn't exist anymore.
So I don't know at all, just to clarify then, I don't know at all what the market is before I try to do a round of funding.
Right. So, and especially if you're kind of in that Oculus Rift, you're trying to sell a computer consumer-based product, it's a little challenging.
Why is it that they ruled that way? I don't understand what the danger is in finding out, if I'm an entrepreneur, letting the entrepreneur figure out exactly what the size of this market would be.
Yeah, it's a little quirky. There's this thing called general solicitation. And that's like a really, that's a technical term of art right there that historically, when you were trying to do a private offering, you could only raise money from people within your network or someone you had a pre-existing relationship with. That's kind of like the legal jargon around it. And what they really wanted to do was extend that. It's kind of crazy because there's an offering type called 506C, which was part of the Jobs Act, and I can advertise if it's to accredited investors. I can't advertise here if it happens to be regular investors. I don't actually know why you would make that distinction. To me, it's actually counterintuitive because you want the broadest base of investors. That's a good thing for companies, right?
Right.
Forget about the investor, but if I'm a company, I want to have as many investors as possible. That spreads the risk, gets, you know, better word of mouth. And the whole idea behind the Jobs Act is using what we all kind of call social media to get the word out there, to get these companies funded. It's one of those ones that's kind of a little bit of a head scratcher, if you will.
Yeah, but it also sounds like, you know, where when I first heard about this ruling that the safety guards had all come off, all the accredited investor language had completely come off. It sounds to me like what you're saying is it's only really half come off.
Yeah, and maybe even three quarters come off okay. in terms of kind of the companies we want. One of the challenging things you have there also is companies can only raise $1 million over a 12-month period. And so that's really challenging because if you kind of look at the stats in the industry, so a company who's raising a seed round, in 2015, the average seed round raise is $2.5 million. So already, if I think I want to raise that kind of money, I'm out. I can't use it. You know, I'm not going to go that direction. The third one is the cost.
Actually, before you get to that, let me ask you a question about the second one here, Greg. Because let's say when you say the $1 million, let's say I'm a company. So I'm thinking about one of the podcasts I like is called Startup, and this company, Gimlet Media, they really wanted to allow their listeners to invest in the company because they did this whole first season about them trying to find investors. And then they realized partway through the season that these that people had to be accredited, right? And so they talked about it and said, hey, if you're accredited, you might be able to get in, but everybody else can't. Now that that's off, when you say $1 million, could they have raised $1 million from non-accredited investors and then gotten the other $1.5 million from accredited? Can you split it up?
You can split it up. I would say they would not have been able to because that podcast would have been deemed advertising.
Oh.
And so they would have been in a pickle for sure.
Got it. Okay.
Unfortunately, yeah. Which would be a great medium to get the word out. But in that case, that would definitely be deemed advertising.
Well, and what that also does too is it lets some of your customers participate. Like you're talking about Oculus. Let's say the Oculus just wants to be, you know, wants to be a good citizen for their customers or let their customers in on their deal. They get most of the money from accredited investors. It would allow them to get a little bit from, you know, people that buy the riff.
Yeah, and it's a really good example. So say I'm a company that's worth $20 million. I'm embracing social media, you know, the whole let's break the rules here. Not break the rules, that's a bad word. You know, embrace technology.
There you go.
So we're going to raise some money from accredited investors, and we're going to raise some money from everyone else, or the regular retail investor, the crowd. One of the challenges that occurs is that if the company raises has more than 500 retail or crowd investors, and they have assets more than $25 million, they now have to report like they're a public company, they're Microsoft. And so now you're talking about a whole stack of compliance and reporting requirements. And again, that's kind of counterintuitive because we want companies to be successful and we shouldn't then overly burden them for being successful. I mean, you got Uber, which is a $60 billion. You'd have more reporting requirements than Uber and you'd only be worth maybe $25 million. Oh. So it's like, you could just kind of see where there's just a misalignment in regulatory environment versus what's really going to help these companies be successful.
So let's talk about this then from the investor side, Greg, which it sounds like what you're telling me is if I'm an investor, I might not be seeing you ever see the movie Glengarry Glen Ross? And they always talk about the Glengarry, right? The really great housing. We might not be seeing the Glengarry deals then.
Yeah, I would say, and I've heard a number of people say it this way, is that, you know, really Reg CF is for companies who've been unable to secure funding kind of through the traditional venture capital space, which is really problematic because now you're kind of getting companies that are kind of doing a last ditch effort to try and raise this money. And that kind of just, it's not really the spot. If we're trying to get people to invest in private businesses, don't we want to give them a taste of companies that have had some success that are maybe worth more than $25 million? But here we're saying you've actually got to take the largest amount of risk possible to participate.
Wow. So if I do think now, let's say I'm not an accredited investor. I think most of the people that listen to this podcast probably aren't, right? Just if you look at the population in general, most people are not accredited investors. If I've never been exposed to these type of deals in the past, what are some of the things that I should look out for? And what are some of the points that I should really focus in on when evaluating whether this is a good idea for my money or not?
Yeah. So if we're thinking about how do we kind of really invest in maybe, you know, the 50 times returns versus, you know, a guy who's maybe got three restaurants and he's looking to expand to a sixth or a seventh. You know, there's kind of, can I invest in the next Oculus Rift or am I really just investing locally? And there could be reasons you want to do both. I think the first thing is that it's going to take a lot of work. If you think about how much venture capital makes up of, let's just say, an institution here, it's really only about 2-4% of someone's portfolio, but they probably have somewhere between 20 and 50 holdings. Oh. So you're talking about, one, you're not going to want to throw your money all out there in one shot. I'm going to invest in 20 companies this month. That's a terrible idea. You know, you probably want to do it over a period of time. So you kind of really got to think about, I'm going to build a portfolio of startups if you're going to be successful. And then you're going to probably want to do it over like a 2-year period. I mean, that's kind of how funds do it. They don't raise money and just blow it out the door. They build a portfolio and they try and have exposure to different areas.
It's almost like with anything else, like, you know, we tell people about dollar cost averaging, right? You're talking about diversification and dollar cost averaging in, which is the same thing you do with exchange traded funds or mutual funds anyway.
Yeah. There's kind of two ways I can think about it. You could see a company that you like, maybe it's in the technology space, and you're like, oh, I'd like to take a flyer on that company. No different than taking a flyer on a newly IPO company, right? That's kind of just take it. Maybe it's in the biotech space. No different. It's going to take up a small part of your portfolio. But if you're really trying to say, I want to be in this space, right? I want to really follow it and build a portfolio around it. It's a pretty significant undertaking.
What do I request? Or there's something that they have to give me? Like, I'm assuming that there's a bunch of numbers that I should be looking at, right?
Right.
I'm thinking about who's that comedian that talks about numbers and stuff? should I be looking at?
The good thing is that you can only make an offering through a portal. That's a real positive. So you have these portals and they kind of act like curators. They just don't let anyone list on their portal, right? It's not like an MLS where you just find all the real estate. What they do is they kind of do a screening process and they allow only certain companies to basically access the crowd. So that's a good thing. That's a curative process. So hopefully there's some sort of filter process there. And then the law says there are certain information you have to supply to investors. One is, if you're going to do a $1 million deal, you have to have financials that are at least reviewed. They don't have to be audited, but they have to be reviewed by an accounting. So from there, the good thing is that you should be getting a good, clean set of numbers to review. They've got to give you any sort of information, whether anyone's a bad actor. And bad actor means, have I had a bankruptcy? Have I been, you know, suspended by a regulatory agency? So one, the people generally have to be, you know, clean operators. So from a historical perspective. And then three, they've got to present a very clean, they can't be too pie in the sky with the description of what the business plan is, right? It's got to be a little more factual based. So they can't just give you a sales job, if you will. So those things are all positive. And those are all going to be on when you log into the funding portal, the website. All of those things are very easily found, a good readable format. And then the other thing that the portals have to do is that they actually have to provide a level of education. And really a lot of it is from the risk standpoint that, hey, these things are really illiquid. You probably want to think about how much you're going to invest. What's your timeline for getting your money back? What are the probabilities? You know, generally it's, you know, 7% of, you know, startups kind of succeed. So they kind of give you another level of education outside of that specific deal, which is a positive as well.
Is that the business that you guys are in, Greg?
We're not in the Reg CF space.
Okay.
We're kind of see how that space kind of matures. Congressman McHenry, he's the congressman who actually started the Jobs Act. He was the sponsor of the Jobs Act. He actually already has a number of fixes that he's trying to get passed through Congress that are going to address some of these concerns we specifically talked about. And if they actually can get those fixes through, it could really change the landscape of Reg CF. Like, they're going to raise the minimum from 1 to 5 million. You're going to be able to do this thing called test the waters, which we talked about earlier. They're going to eliminate that 500 investor reporting like a public company. So he kind of realizes what the challenges are. And if he can make those changes, that we would then enter that space. We focus, it's really called a private investment platform. In that space, we offer deals and projects and funds to accredited investors, but also one of the regulations that got passed in Jobs Act is a thing called Regulation A+. And that's kind of a hybrid between accredited crowdfunding and Reg CF, in that the trade-off is, if I'm a company, I want to raise up to $50 million. If I'm willing to get my financials audited and do a type of reporting, a semi-annual report and an annual auditing report, kind of like a mini IPO, not quite as complicated as that type of reporting, but I could raise $50 million and I can raise it from anyone. And that's really the spot we've seen kind of take off here in the last year.
Got it. And I would guess that you're going to see these, I guess what you're predicting is that these may merge further. Like, you'll see more of a blurring of the lines.
Yeah, I think the spot, if I was a company, and the challenge that the company has to make the decisions, that am I okay with the compliance with the extra reporting that has to go on? I'd rather go Reg A plus every day of the week because I can raise up to $50
sure.
million. Dollars,
right.
And I don't have these same issues that I have under Reg CF. So to me, that's really the spot. Or people are going to go to the traditional, which is called the 506B, which just means I can raise money only from accredited investors and I have to know them beforehand.
So there are people that are non accredited investors that can get in on some of these bigger deals is what you're saying. And that's the playground you work in.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You can see, and there's our platform, Crowdfunder, Seed Invest. Those are a couple of companies that are playing in the Reg A space. And when you go to the website, you'll see a company listed and it'll just say whether it's a Reg A offering, whether it's a Reg C offering, or what's termed a Reg B offering, you know, the traditional one. It just means, can I get that information publicly? Do I have to be an accredited investor and sign up? It's kind of like a dashboard and it's kind of seamless to the investor. It just depends, you know, how much can they invest? Can they actually invest? And I think what we'll see is that will grow. That Reg A plus space, I think, will grow.
I want to get back for a second to the numbers because there's a few questions that I haven't asked you yet there. And most people listening to this podcast, I think, have no idea about how to evaluate a startup. Should I be looking for sales numbers already, Greg, in most cases? Should I be looking for some type of, like, I'm thinking about the show Shark Tank, right? They ask them, so what kind of sales have you had so far? And what have your expenses been? Like, what line items that I'm going to see might be some red flags?
Yeah, I think you want to look at sales. You also want to take what's the size of the market, right? So if it's a $20 billion market, maybe I only need to capture 1% of that marketplace to have really significant sales. Okay. So that's a really, if it's more of a, you know, 50 million marketplace, well, that's a totally different dynamic. I probably got to capture a lot of it. The other thing, whenever I look at these numbers, and the biggest thing to me is I always look at, when will you get to either cash flow positive or break even? How long is it going to take there? And I cut that number in half. If they think it's going to cost, you know, it's going to take 2 years and it's only going to take $1 million, I say it's going to take you 4 years and cost you $2 million. Do I think the company is going to be able to hit certain goals that if they need to, they can raise additional capital? So it's a combination of factors. Can they get the profitability? Can they hit the sales goals? Or, you know, depending on the product, is it, you know, users, if it's, you know, kind of a social media type thing, what are the goals that give other investors the green light to say, these guys are executing well, I'm willing to now put up additional money? You know, how do they get to that next level?
Which will allow them to accelerate.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Now, when you say cut it in half, I think what you actually mean is
double it.
Yeah, you double the license. So you assume that every number they'd give you is too rosy.
Oh, always 50% discount on all that. And that just comes from experience. I mean, we've looked at hundreds and hundreds of companies and no one, no matter how hard they try, they never hit those numbers just because something changes. And usually the company has to pivot in some fashion, right? Either they learn something new about the market, a new competitor comes in, and they have to change the direction of the company slightly.
And then when you talked about the size of the market, where am I going to get that number from? Because it seems like even if they tell me what they think the size of their market is, I should be able to independently verify that some other way.
Yeah, a lot of times if it's a really good disclosure document, it'll say they would actually use a third party to say, you know, according to Mass Solution or XYZ company, you know, they determine the market is $50 million. And then I just, you know, you could go Google it or verify it or contact that company to verify it.
Yeah, got it. Okay. Well, that's fantastic news, Greg. So the URL for me to get to your platform?
It's altzinv.com.
altzinv.com is the place to go. Fantastic. And for people out walking the dog or driving in their car, we'll have a link to that on our show notes at moneytreepodcast.com. So what's next for you guys, Greg?
We've brought our first project online, which was, you know, a solar farm, has a lot of unique characteristics, and where we are trying to help people, because my personal viewpoint is that you got equity markets that are probably going to make probably somewhere 3-4% over the next decade. That's a real challenge. I think John Bogle, right, the captain of index equity indexing at Vanguard, he said only expect 3-4% returns over the next decade. We got fixed income markets that are paying us nothing. And so what we're trying to solve is kind of this current yield. If we can give people 6-8% return, and we kind of call it an equity kicker, think of a real estate play. to commercial building. We're leasing that building out to a AA credit, you know, a Walmart, a Target, a pretty good sized company. And we got a 20-year lease with them. We build that building, we lease it out, we get some current income, and then eventually we might sell the building. That kind of opportunity where an investor can come in, could never get access to that opportunity in the past. And now on our platform, you can invest as little as $5,000. You get current income. It's almost equity-like, right? If I could get you 8% return on a real estate, that's kind of what equities average over a decade, right? 8 to 10% sure. annual returns. Right. So those are the kind of things we're trying to find, given this market environment, what kind of, honestly, you know, truly different avenues of return can investors get that they can say, hey, that's kind of equity-like, or it would fill my equity component. I could take, you know, a little sliver out of my equity portfolio and put it in here. And I know for the next 10 years, I'm going to be collecting rent because it's a good tenant. And I got some upside.
Man, that's too bad you got nothing going on. But that actually brings up another question, which is interesting, which is, you know, whenever people get into investments, Stephen Covey always said, you should look at the other side of the stick, which is, how do I get my money out, right? When I'm looking at these opportunities, whether it's that opportunity or another opportunity, does it list what the means are where I'm actually going to have a return on my investment?
Right, yeah. In some cases, let's just, if it's a Reg CF, this is another issue. They're technically freely tradable after a year, meaning if I owned equity, 1 year later, if I could find someone to sell it to, the regulations allow me to sell it. How that's really going to materialize, is there going to be a secondary market? We don't know. On the Reg A+, they're actually freely tradable right away. And there's a lot of people, what they do is they list them on the OTC bulletin board. And so there's some liquidity, which is a step in the right direction. And what happens is hopefully as these markets evolve, those secondary markets will come along over time and provide liquidity. But if you were looking at a straight, let's just say a real estate deal, what a lot of them have, one, you got to be comfortable with the illiquidity. I mean, I stress this to people all the time. That's the most important thing. You got to forget about the money 5, 7, maybe 10 years. But a lot of them have the ability, A, either sell the portfolio, B, refinance the portfolio and get you your initial capital out. But some of them really don't have a lot of specific triggers that say 7 years from now, you will absolutely have your cash back. It just doesn't work that way. What's the market like? What's the acquisition environment like? So that's the biggest hurdle that you got to overcome. So it's really good for retirement type money, right? And a lot of people can use their IRAs to invest in these type of assets because that's long-term money anyway. And so that's where we think it makes a really good fit.
Yeah, that's great advice. People should think of it as having a money tree, right? Just like the name of our show. You're planting right. a tree and you're just taking the apples off it. You don't want to pull up the roots.
Yeah, it should only take up, you know, a certain percentage of your portfolio. Right. Yeah. Maybe 15 to 25 for all of your alternatives. And maybe Reg CF stuff is 5%. So each of these things just plays a small role in the larger portfolio, really.
Well, thanks again for all this information, Greg. This is so brand new that I'm glad you could come on and talk to our listeners about it. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, it was great being on the show. Thanks for having me.
Hey, everybody. We're back here for part number two of our exciting Greg Flynn episode of the show. Let's introduce our crazy people around this wonderful nationwide table that we have. We'll start off, I believe, in Idaho, where the sleepiest person on this podcast, Miranda Marquette, joins us.
Hey.
You going to try to act like you're awake?
Sure. I am tired, but upbeat.
Yes, because you love this topic.
Woo.
Absolutely. And somebody else who is, I'm sure, excited about this topic, Linda P. Jones, who's out in the desert in what, California?
California. Hello. How are you?
What's happening?
Hey, I'm just trying to stay cool. We're going to have 120 degrees on Monday.
That is so sad. It's like 98 degrees and about 140% humidity here.
Ooh.
Yeah, but because you guys don't get the humidity, right? So it's 120, but it's not humid, so it's fine.
Yeah, they always say it's dry heat, so it's cool, but right. That's not really true. It's really, really hot.
it's just a lie to get more people to come.
Yeah.
Right. And a place where it's probably not desert at all, right, in Israel is Doug Goldstein.
It is beautiful here, about 85 and sunny, although I just came in from Amsterdam, where it's totally weird because it doesn't get dark till about 10:30 or 11 at night. And it gets light at like 5 in the morning. So definitely I've been in strange places.
Why are the – when I was in southern France recently, this is not the topic of our show, but the morning stars seem to start earlier and the day started later than it does here in Texas. Anybody have any idea why that is?
Isn't it the position of the country where it is?
Well, I would think, Linda, it would either get dark, you know, the sun would come up later then, but the sun came up way early, and it also, I don't know.
Set late. No, that's like up in Alaska. The further north you get, it's like that, where you get fewer hours of night during the summer, and you get very few hours of daylight in the winter.
That's good. We have a geography lesson. We are not going to charge extra for that, everybody. That makes total sense. So now that I'm blushing, let's go into our topic today, because that is totally right, and I should have thought about that. So Greg talked about these new opportunities for everybody, not just accredited investors, to get in on some of these venture capital ideas. So my first question is, and Doug, let's start with you. Do you see this widening of venture capital type investing to be a win for the little guy, or is this something that's going to separate fools and their money?
Well, in principle, I'm always happy when the government gets its hands out of our life. I think that there's just a limit to how much protection the government can do to protect everyone from everything. So the concept of removing some of the regulations and getting people involved in handling their own money and taking their own responsibility sounds fine. As a financial advisor, though, I was trying to think, which of my clients would I bring some of these ideas to? And I still have a white piece of paper with not a single name on it, because I just don't see doing this as, for fun, or if it interests you, it's great. But let's realize this is just like a lottery. You know, it's not that, I should have known about Facebook and Twitter and Microsoft and Google. You know, some people were lucky and some people weren't. This goes against, I think, what we normally talk about here, which is spread out the risk and don't swing for the bleachers.
Yeah, Linda, I totally agree with Doug there. But do you see that maybe coming up in the future, you're going to have more of your readers and listeners that are bringing these opportunities to you, asking you to help them through them?
I think that they are, and I just want to make the distinction between the Reg CF crowdfunding versus the Reg A.
Right.
Because I'm really not a fan of the Reg CF. I think it is, you know, it's just fraught with problems, and I'm really interested in the return of my money, not just the return on my money. And in this case, I think there's some question about the return of your money. It's illiquid. It's very long term. I'd say, he said 7 to 10 years. I'd say probably beyond 10 years is, you know, likely for many of these companies. What really bothered me is the financials are reviewed but not audited. That really, really bothers me, because that leaves the door open for a lot of abuse. And these are also passed over by venture capitalists. They are a last-ditch effort to raise money, and there's a high risk of loss. So these early-stage companies aren't really tested, and I think that you have to be really careful investing in these. So I'm not a big fan of the crowdfunding, but I do later want to talk about Reg A.
Yeah.
Do we know these deals are passed over by the VCs, or are the founders just trying to avoid VCs? Because sometimes the VCs are like vultures. They come in and just take over your whole project.
Well, I would say that if they are a company that could get venture capital, I think they would go that route, because not only are they getting money from them, but they're getting direction from them as well. So I think anyone, certainly if I were in their shoes, I would want to go the venture capital funding route if I could, and only do this if I couldn't do anything else.
We have a guy coming on, Stacking Benjamins, who is one of the few guys that I've met that are actually doing Reg CF, even though he could get venture capital money. He's a guy that he's taken two companies already to the top of Inc. magazine, or Inc.'s top small business list, like best small businesses. He's taken two companies there, so he could clearly get that. But I don't think he needs the direction, and he really wants to involve the people that are using his product. But it also seemed Greg brought up on our interview today, brought up some great problems, Linda, that you're echoing.
Yeah. And I mean, he brought up the problems that Senator or Congressman McHenry is trying to fix as well. So if those are fixed, that would also make that more attractive. And I love the idea that he is an experienced business person that's had past success that wants to bring this to the public. I love that idea. And if it goes that direction and it gains popularity, then that could change my opinion.
Yeah. Nope. Miranda, do you see you adding any of this stuff to your portfolio?
Yeah, so here's the interesting thing. I actually was approached by a platform that helps with this crowdfunding, equity crowdfunding stuff called Kickfurther. And they gave me $60 to play around with. I'm actually in the process of trying it out.
Wow.
But one of the interesting things about these platforms that grow up around this crowdfunding is that rather than going through this process of, okay, hey, you're going to have these shares and we're going to vote on it, it works a lot like other kind of crowdfunding where, you know, you put in your money, then they finance it, and then you get your perk. Well, so this doesn't offer perks, but you put in your money, they estimate how much of a return you're going to get, and then once it's funded and they start doing whatever it is they're doing, then they start paying you back. So it's kind of like P2P lending in a way, only with it's an interesting kind of platform to sort of do it on. And so I picked three different companies and did $20 in each, and we'll see how it goes. All of them were fully funded, and I picked three companies that had actually done funding runs before. So a lot of the companies on these types of platforms are a little different in that a lot of them are just doing it so that they can fund the next run of their product or the next stage of whatever it is they're doing. And so they're looking for kind of smaller amounts, like tens of thousands of dollars instead of millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars.
But does that bother you that they need to go to you for that kind of liquidity instead of having that? It seems like they could go to one investor and get that kind of money.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about it really yet. And I mean, I guess I'll see whether I get my money. Well, it's not even my money. It's Kickfurther's money. But I'll see once I start getting money back. We'll see if that works. But I think it's an interesting way for companies who are like, well, we just need a couple, you know, we just need $10,000 to do our next product run, build up our inventory, but we don't want to have to go through this hassle of going to the bank and asking for a small business loan because that takes forever, or trying to find a venture capitalist who's going to be in for this. It's a relatively small amount of money. You know, this is faster and we can get it done. I mean, these guys, you know, they opened their offering, had it funded in 3 days, and then were able to move on. If you go to one venture capitalist, like Linda was kind of pointing out, and like you were kind of pointing out as well, if you go to one venture capitalist and say, hey, or an angel investor and say, hey, you know, we want this money, they want a piece of your company, they want extra this, they want control. And that sort of ties it up and can slow it down. So for companies who are like, hey, we just want to get some money and get this thing going or do another run of our product, I actually think this is kind of a cool thing because it moves the process faster for them. And it gives other people a chance to sort of get in on it as well.
What expectations do you have for liquidity events? Did any of these companies tell you when to expect that you might have a shot at getting your money back?
Yeah, a lot of them have within a year, Yeah, which is different from these other things. Because like I said, a lot of these companies are doing it. Like one of them is like, hey, we're doing our next round of, you know, classy pocket squares. And so basically they just need to produce their pocket squares and then sell them and then start paying you back.
So these are more traditional type companies, not like tech or new inventions or something like that?
So this is pretty much a completely different spin on the crowdfunding thing.
Which is funny because, you know, when Greg was talking, he was drawing a difference between the companies where you're trying to 10x your money and one where you're maybe trying to get incremental gains. Some of these you're trying to make incremental gains, it sounds like.
Yeah, pretty much. And so it's kind of a different approach to it where they're just like, hey, we just need this money and then we'll start paying you back. And you're not buying into the company.
Paying you back implies it's a loan. It's not equity in the company.
Right. Yeah. And so in order to get around the whole loan thing, they do call it like an investment. They do call it equity. But then basically it's like they're buying it back from you.
But then they buy your shares back.
Yeah. So basically it's like they're buying it back from you so that if you don't get your money back. But all the three companies I picked, they had funded before using this platform and they had had an early payback for the money. So, you know, I'm like, hey, there's a pretty good chance then, right?
Yeah. Are they telling you what the rate of return is that you're going to get?
Yeah. They give you an estimated rate of return based on what they got last time. I mean, you may not get that, of course. I mean, this
sure.
There's always the chance it's going to be wrong. Then, and a lot of them have a long history of their company and what they do. And of course, as Linda was pointing out, like none of this is audited. I don't even know how well the review is. You're just like basically looking at it and going, hey, this looks cool. You know, I like what you're saying about yourself. So you're kind of taking it on faith. But, you know, like I said, it's $60 that someone else gave me. So I was like, this is kind of, you know, interesting to try out and an interesting approach.
So it's a game, not an investment, the way you're describing it.
Kind of, from my perspective. But I think that it could be an interesting investment for people who, like always, are kind of looking for something a little different to do and have the money and understand that they, you know, could very well lose that money.
Doug, if somebody brings one of these types of opportunities to you, we talked to Greg a little bit about what data you should be mining in that company to try to protect your investment, get as much information as possible. But what data do you think is important to ask about some of these venture capital ideas?
Yeah. First of all, I want to comment that I really like his name. I think it's a cool name, Greg Flynn.
Yeah, like Errol Flynn.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's the first thing I would look at. Like, I would look at the founder's name.
The guy's name, right. Yeah. If they've got a cool name.
I want to give him money.
Yes, that's right.
You know, the thing they always say, and all the VC guys that I know when they're looking at a company, they don't really care what the product is, and they don't care what the numbers are and the fancy Excel spreadsheets. They just care who the people are. And I think that's where I would start, is to make sure that the people that I know those people. Because anyone can, you know, you spend a couple of $5, in fact, on Fiverr.com, and you get a cool video about some product. But that'll excite a lot of people to invest. But, you know, again, for games, you're going to invest $20 or $60 or $100, no big deal. But if you're talking about a long-term investment, you have to know who the people are. And don't forget, the people who are getting the money, I don't know if you guys remember, there was a movie like 15 years ago with Danny DeVito called, I think it was just called OPM, Other People's Money. And frankly, I don't really remember what the movie was about. But one of the things that I've seen with people who raise money at any level, whether it's, you know, raising their first $10,000 from their parents to start their company, or companies who've raised $100 million or more, you know, to really expand, all of a sudden the mentality when they're spending other people's money radically changes compared to when it's their own money on the line. And that's really the big issue that I would be worrying about, which is why, you know, if someone needs $5,000 or $10,000 or $20,000, come on, he has to do it this way. He couldn't put up his own money. And I get that not everyone has it, but you got to wonder what they're going to be thinking when they're spending your money instead of their own.
And that's a great, I mean, if you have the opportunity to ask that question, I think that's a great question to ask, isn't it?
I would definitely go for it.
What when you say the people, I want to dig into that just a little bit, Doug, because what is it about the people that you're specifically looking for? Are you looking for education or what do you want to see?
I'm looking for drive. It's just last week, the guy came in who I've known for years, and he has a fairly successful small web-based company. He makes enough money to feed his wife and kids. And he was telling me, he said, Doug, I want to raise some money and build my business. So I brought him in and to talk him out of the idea because I thought it was ridiculous. What I told him, which I find I regularly tell people when they ask me that, is you're doing fine. Just grow organically and look at the things you're doing that are making money. You know, figure out where your actual revenues are being made. What's the 20%, you know, the 20-80 rule, right? The 80-20 rule. What are the few things you're doing that are actually making money? And just do more of that. I really believe that businesses can grow organically and will do much better than when they just get money. Because just getting cash, you know, in the bank really messes you up. You don't really think about the business holistically. You just get so excited about the cash. And so I would be looking for people who can understand the need to grow slow but steady and can take that approach.
Yeah, but cash can also jumpstart your business. I mean, you can go from phase one to phase four in a hurry, Doug.
So which small businesses can you think of that, like, you know, and let's not talk about Facebook, but, you know, guys you know in your neighborhood who all of a sudden, you know, someone gave them $20,000 or $25,000 and they went to phase four. I don't really know what that is, by the way.
I don't know either. But you know what I mean is that you can start a lot bigger with more capital.
I don't believe that. I think that's what everyone says, and I get it. I hear the argument, but I think normal guys like you and me who are starting business and Linda and Miranda, you know, people who are just starting businesses, I don't think they can really jump that far.
Linda, you use numbers in all of your everyday investing. Are there any specific numbers you'd be looking for from venture capital opportunities?
Well, you know, I'm always looking at earnings, but there are some other things besides the numbers.
Yeah, because these companies wouldn't really have earnings yet, you know?
Well, it depends. It depends.
I mean, they might have sales.
Yeah, it depends. It depends what kind of company. But I think there's more important things than the numbers. And what I wanted to talk about were things like the moat around the business, which is what Warren Buffett talks about, which is what's your competitive advantage? What's going to separate you from the competition? Do you have patents? Do you have something that competitors aren't going to be able to copy? Because you can be the first technology out there, but the first one isn't always the winner. And sometimes it gets outdated. Sometimes competitors come in and innovate more. You know, you can be the first one with Red Bull out there, but then the barrier is pretty low for other people to create beverages like that. So I look at the moat, what is going to keep others from encroaching on their market share? And maybe nowadays a good thing to do is to aim to disrupt established markets, because if you're looking for a swing for the fences type of a play, which everybody kind of is thinking about in the back of their mind, whether they admit it or not, with this kind of investing, you want to, you know, find that next Uber or find that next company that's going to really disrupt established markets. And that's what I think a lot of VCs are looking for these days too.
That's so funny, because I'm not, when I hear about this, I think about my opportunity to get into a business that might be more like a bank, right? Where a bank doesn't make a lot of money on any deal. Well, they make great money on some deals, but better than that, they make money on every deal, right? So it's like a cash cow, like a alarm company, right? Where people barely end up using it, but they still pay that monthly fee.
I mean, if I'm going to do that, I'll just buy an established large cap stock that pays a dividend. Why would I want to take extra risk to do this?
It depends on what the multiplier is. If the multiplier is bigger, if it's, you know, can give me four times what I got otherwise, then yeah, I'd want to do that.
I mean, I just think that this type of investing is very, very high risk, and therefore it should be high reward.
Right. Miranda, is there any data, anything that you would be on your list of things to ask of a venture capital investment?
Well, I think Doug pretty much summed it up when he talked about looking at the team, looking at the people involved. I've actually been interviewing a lot of venture capitalists for some different, for a series of articles I've been working on for a client. And a lot of these venture capitalists, as well as angel investors that I've talked to, say the same thing. They say they're more interested in the team. Is the team competent? What's their background? Are they the kind of people who can pivot if they need to and still come out with a great result? And then the other thing is not so much metrics, I guess, to look at, but more of remember to diversify. I think they're saying like 80% to 90% of these companies, like people who invest, you lose out 80 to 90% of the time.
Right.
When it comes to this. And so they say, you know, they try and put their money where the team is great, but they also diversify because they know that no matter how great the team is, there's a really good chance that it's going to fail.
Yeah, one win could make up for seven or eight losses.
Right, but let's just realize, first of all, I don't know about that. I just don't know the statistic, 80 to 90%. But even if you do have a win, the win might just be you got your money back. It doesn't mean, you know, you went up 100-fold to more than make up the losses. So don't assume, well, if I just do 10 deals, then one of them will hit and it'll make up and I'll walk away at a big profit.
Yeah, well, Greg mentioned that 7% of startups succeed.
You guys are the naysayers, just pointing out the horrible truth here, which is annoying.
And succeed means what? It just means they were able to pay their bills?
They don't go bankrupt.
Yeah. Right. So let's cap this discussion here. What percentage of somebody's portfolio would you say they should limit this to? Doug, we'll start with you.
I liked what Miranda was saying, $60.
Of somebody else's money.
Yeah, that someone gives you to play with. I see this stuff all the time. In Israel, you should know where I sit, is the startup nation. I mean, we got Waze and we got, you know, all the technology we're using for this call was developed in Israel. But, and I'm here and I know a lot of the guys. I put money in one of these deals, which I lost a big chunk of. So I just can't, I don't see this as part of a traditional long-term investment portfolio.
Bah humbug, Mr. Goldstein.
Sorry, and I'm sorry, Greg, but I do like your name.
Linda, what percentage would you cap this at?
Well, if we could get into more of the Reg A area with audited financials, where it's more like the mini IPO, they're raising.
Let's talk about that for a second.
Up to $50 million, they can get money from anyone. They can test the waters. If we could be more in the Reg A area, I'd say you could go up to 5% of your portfolio in that.
Yeah. And it's my understanding that's where Greg lives also.
That's where Greg lives. And for good reason. I mean, there's a lot of advantages to having, you know, some of that base built beneath the company and understanding all those things. I just think that we need a better distribution system rather than the pink sheets to, you know, find this information and make it more available. So that's, I think, what Greg's company is doing, which I think will be tremendous and will help those smaller companies and help everyone find them and make a better match in the future.
Yeah, it's scary because the pink sheets, as you alluded to earlier, are way too easy for bad guys to manipulate.
Mm-hmm.
Way, way too easy. I got burned on that once before I learned that it's very difficult for regulators to oversee those areas, and because of that, pump and dump strategies and other just messy founders that just want to get their money out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They realize the ship has left. I got involved in one of those. They realized that there really had no product there, so they hired a PR firm to help get me in there and other people. This is early in my career before I learned, just get other people in there to prop up the stock price so they could get their own money out. Then next thing you know, it's lawsuits and bankruptcy, which is great. And I'm left holding the bag. So, yeah, not fun. Miranda, what percentage of a portfolio would you put in there? Do you like the $60 you got in there now? Is that your whole play?
Yeah, so far.
No, but is that going to be the whole play?
I don't know. I think it might be kind of fun to try some other stuff. But like Linda says, I'd say probably limit it to 5% tops. And kind of what Doug said, I would never think of it as like my serious investing strategy. It's just sort of like, hey, this might be a fun way to make a little extra scratch.
But what if they came up with a venture capital index? Then would you giggle?
Maybe. That would be kind of fun. Right
now. That's like a hedge fund index.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
But that's a really good point because if the index really helps with the diversification that Miranda was mentioning, and that is so important when you're investing in these kinds of businesses. And even Greg said that, you know, venture capitalists are going to invest maybe over 2 years, are going to ease into what companies they want to invest in. And you need to develop a portfolio, not just put all your eggs in one basket in this kind of a very risky venture.
Not just praying for the next Apple.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Because that'll happen.
It will happen. Something will slip through and it will succeed like crazy. And then everyone will, you know, be like, oh my gosh, I missed it. And something will. And, you know, that will change the landscape for everyone. But I think that the chances are very, very, very small. I mean, it's got to be like equivalent to a lottery ticket, kind of small.
I love investing the way that Dr. Daniel Crosby talks about, if you guys are familiar with him, where he says, you're just not that special. You know, that you're gonna hit that. Just if you invest as if you're not that special, you're more likely to win. And I really like investing that way. Well, let's talk about what's going on at all of your homes. Why don't we start with Rich as a King, Doug? What's going on over there?
Well, I just came back from Europe. I was in this cool money management conference. And when I was there, I was talking to some of the conference organizers about this concept we have of using strategies from chess to become a better investor. And we also spoke about behavioral finance issues, which we had, Susan Polgar and I had researched in terms of both chess and investing. And they said, well, that sounds pretty cool. Do you guys speak about this? So I said, in fact, we do. So I think we might have gotten ourselves a good gig in New York in September to be speaking at a big money management conference.
Yeah, that's exciting. That's fantastic. Yeah. Congratulations.
Very cool.
Linda, how about at Be Wealthy and Smart?
Well, we've got our regular podcast, but I thought I'd mention number 129, which was a podcast I did about equity crowdfunding questions to consider. So if you want to continue this conversation, go over to Be Wealthy and Smart and look up number 129.
Excellent. And what's happening you know what's funny, Miranda? What do you want to pimp today?
Planting money seeds, man.
Right.
So, yeah, over at plantingmoneyseeds.com, I've got something up on, you know, does your money have a purpose? Like, what is the means to the end of your money? because a lot of us don't think about what our money is actually doing for us, right? My money helps me travel and helps me prepare for the future and helps me find good opportunities for my son. So what is your money doing for you? Go check it out and think about how you can turn your money around and have it provide something for you that you actually enjoy.
That's awesome. And that's at Planting Money Seeds. And at Stacking Benjamins, something similar, Miranda. We have Michael K., CFP, on, and he talks about the fact that because most of us are just out there chasing returns and we don't talk about what's really important in our lives, our money's going one way and our life's going a whole different way. So how to put those together. And a lot of the big discussions that you need to have about money really start from a place that has nothing to do with putting numbers on paper. Like putting numbers on paper is much later. So I think those two are congruent, yours and what we're doing.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, that's it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. If you've got a note for the show, head to moneytreepodcast.com and leave that for us. And we're going to do letters again here in the near future, so we're happy to answer those. If you like what you hear, leave us a review at Stitcher, iTunes, or wherever you listen. That helps us find new listeners. If you don't like our show, remember our podcast is called Listen Money Matters. That's a joke, guys. Yeah, sorry. That was such a bad joke. But anyway, on that note, Miranda, you want to bring us home?
Remember that no one will take care of your money as well as you do. So make sure to invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.